These are the Target Files, taking a 21st century look back at the 20th century and now 21st century adventures of the Doctor in novelization and audiobook form, looking through the eyes of adulthood at our childhood memories. After all, a great Time Lord once said, "There's no point in being grown up if you can't be childish some of the time."
Hello there, this is episode 72 of the Target Files, and today we are discussing The Curse of Peladon, book by Brian Hales and audiobook read by David Troughton. This is Alex in Exeter.
And hi from Mike in Swansea.
So, what did we think of Curse of Peladon? A bit of a political satire romp thrown in with a bit of sort of Greek myth, I thought.
What got me throughout, I'll got to say that horrible word at the moment, Brexit. But the opposite.
It is very Brexity sort of political, isn't it?
Well, I suppose at the time when Britain was looking to go into the EEC, as it was then, became the EU, it's Brenta, really, isn't it? It's when they were looking to enter it, as the Peladonians are looking to enter the Galactic Federation in this story.
On one hand, typical John Pertwee, you know, romp with lots of action going on. And on the other side, it's very dry with the political, you know, machinations of, you know, the joyous squeaky Alpha Centauri and Peladons and the Ice Warriors. It has that sort of feel of, like, West Wing or something like that, I think.
Oh, you've used the word machinations there. Do we get the word machinations from Machiavellian plot?
Yeah, I think that's where it comes from. Machiavellian and all that sort of intonation with, you know, the Borgias and all that sort of era of Roman politics, basically.
Absolutely, and we're set up with characters pretty early on. In the novelisation and the TV story, we see the characters on the planet before we return to Joe and the Doctor arriving in the TARDIS. We have the King, played on TV by Patrick Troughton's eldest son, David. Just a few years after his dad left the role, now with John Pertwee in the early 70s, of course, as the Doctor. How do you feel David came across, both on screen and in the audiobook? I thought he brought a great deal of gravitas, having had 30 or 40 years behind his career now, since this story, when it was released on audiobook a good few years ago, Al.
Yeah, I think, he plays Peladon really well in the actual TV episodes, and I thought the audiobook was very well read for him. I do have a few niggles with the audiobook, we'll come to that later. But I think as Peladon himself, I think he's very wanting this whole alliance and gets quite upset when sort of people around him start dying mysteriously. So I think David Troughton plays it very well, and he's got a great sort of acting history there now, and sort of has regular roles in the English soap The Archers as one of the characters now. So he's sort of done lots of different things over his lifetime. But I think he's a great politician who wants this sort of make his planet part of Earth and, you know, have Federation and all that sort of political stuff, and doesn't want to be stuck in the past. I think he does it very well.
Yes, David returned to Doctor Who, of course, the new series a decade ago in Midnight.
Oh, but it's fantastic in Midnight. It's still one of my favourite underplayed episodes. So I know a lot of people either like it or don't like it. I think Midnight is one of the very, very clever Doctor Who recent episodes.
Mine too, one of the ones I think I'd love to see how they tackled a novelisation of it, which we may get now, of course, with the new series adaptations.
Yeah, that's one of definitely on my list of, if we get on the new Target books, so that would be fantastic to get more depth into Midnight and find out why they're all there. I think that's one of those things that felt brilliant, but still felt a little bit squashed in TV land. But I think David, you know, whatever David Troughton does, you know, he's got that sort of history of, you know, Pat Troughton's family and the complications there, as we've both probably read the autobiography, and it's sort of very interesting how good an actor David Troughton is these days.
Yeah, his younger brother Michael did the autobiography of Pat, been available as an audiobook for a number of years now, well worth a listen.
Oh, it's very worth a listen. You know, it was the sort of big sort of revelation what came out with, you know, with Patrick Troughton. It's sort of very interesting how not being damaged in some ways and being damaged in other ways as an acting dynasty. I think it's a very interesting read. I've got the audiobook and it's very good.
Anyhow, Curse of Peladon, I think we were doing, Al, wasn't it?
Yeah, Curse of Peladon. So we did go off on a tangent there. Curse of Peladon is a really interesting book, I think, because it's very political, but you then have all the sort of normal Doctor Who stuff where you have a monster, you have this sort of on the monster who's sort of their religious cult sort of monster, and he's sort of the one everybody believes in, and then using that to frighten people, I think, works really well, really.
To get a total hold on Agador, really, to me, did he represent both the sort of noble symbol of power and, I suppose, the word in the current political climate would be sovereignty, but also the fear of the unknown on the other side of something like Brexit, you know, of we've had that Project Fear idea that was done around the campaign. Does he represent sort of elements of both those things?
Yeah, I think in a way he does, because, you know, he's sort of meant to be like an icon, a religious icon, everybody's afraid of, and he's sort of, you know, that's they think all the, getting, you know, the people being killed are being killed by him because of religious reason, and he's sort of used as a scapegoat later. Well, I think he comes over better in the TV episodes than he does in the book. I found him a bit lackluster. The whole bit, you know, where the Doctor gets him, you know, does the lullaby, but I think there's a lot better actually in the TV episodes than it was in the book.
Just enchanted by John Pertwee's performance, really, of the lullaby, and then the scene towards the end where Agador's sort of following him around as if he's just the owner of his own pet.
Yeah, I think that works well in the book, but it doesn't have the sort of impact. I can remember that whole thing being really sort of powerful in the episodes. I haven't, because I haven't had a ton of Watson this week, but I can remember the episodes, and they're really well done. That's a whole sort of Roman sort of pit fight with John Pertwee. I thought they just didn't come over that great in the book, I thought.
But I would say Brian Hales has a lovely descriptive flourish of language, you know, as he describes the TARDIS in the opening scene when they materialise on the cliff face, and how futuristic and sumptuous he describes it as inside.
Oh, yeah, I think his descriptions are brilliant as well. I think the way he describes the inside of the castle and the sort of, you know, the tunnels and that bit at the beginning when the TARDIS falls off the cliff and they hang on the cliff is really well done, I think.
Yeah, and I thought he did add a bit at the end with, is it Hepesh that Agador swipes out as and eventually finishes off?
Yeah, when that bit gets added, and I think that works better sometimes, that's, you have that.
I think in the book he's very descriptive of that, and it's over in an instant in the TV version. I think that is a bit of an improvement on that scene.
Basically one of the scenes that has been improved, I think in the actual episode it sort of happens and you blink, you'd miss it, really.
Other character-wise, of course, we have Alpha Centauri, who appeared back in Empress of Mars again, the same actress, 92 years of age now, voicing her last season for Peter Capaldi. Izan Churchman, I think, was the lady's name, who came out of retirement for that.
I don't know if it's just you. I have slight problems with Alpha Centauri because he's just very squeaky. I thought David, you know, his impersonation was rather good, but I just got a bit jarred with her, Ben, because it's so squeaky.
Yeah, sort of muddles through the story and swings between both sides, really, doesn't she, of the argument. Coming in as a delegate, she almost put me in mind of a certain Mrs. May in the government, I think, at times, in her kind of situation.
Thinking about that now, I would agree, actually. He's very, sort of tries to be on both sides of the argument with the whole of the book, really. And, you know, I just don't know, you know, that costume is so ridiculous, basically. Well, it's laughable sometimes.
Yeah, just a superb way of getting away with it. Just the eye on the screen in Empress of Mars last year, because there's no way they would have got away with that shape in modern TV without it being utterly ridiculed.
Well, we all know it's a very, very phallic symbol they made, Alpha Centauri. And I think in the Empress of Mars, it just worked a bit better seeing the eye, that's all.
Yes, and it did make me giggle that the original idea dropped from the TV show, according to TARDIS Wikia, and we do notice it in this adaptation, novelisation and audiobook. The original idea from TARDIS Wiki page that Alpha Centauri's colour changed to reflect their mood was retained in the novelisation. That could add a whole other level of sniggering, I think. Schoolboy sniggering.
Oh, I think so at the time. Yeah, that bit is in the book. Once he gets annoyed, he like changes darker colours. I think that would have been even more ridiculous to try and do that back then.
Yes, how do you feel Joe came across in this book, Al? We have the love interest with the king. I think it's played well, and he's not a very sort of pushy royal in terms of wanting her to get married, is he? He seems sort of almost quite needy in David Trant's performance, both throughout the audiobook and the TV version.
I think it's sort of Joe's performance gets better throughout the book. To begin with, it starts off being quite doctor screaming, you know, why am I here, sort of thing. Well, I think by the time it gets to near the end of the book, you know, she's having to deal with the whole where, you know, Peladon wants her to be his bride because he thinks she's a, you know, an earth princess, and the way she deals with that is quite nicely done, I think. And I think the whole, you know, the whole way what she thinks the Ice Warriors are the main villains when they're not really, and that works really well for, I think.
Short, I think around about 8 or 9 minute documentary on the DVD release called Katie and John about their relationship throughout the series is a very poignant and good look back at that. And we know from meeting Katie herself at many conventions, she's still so very fond of that relationship, the working relationship with John.
Yeah, so that relationship is still very important to it. And even though, you know, Katie Manning is fantastic, if you ever get a chance to meet her, do. Because she's just one of these people you can listen to for hours, all her stories from that sort of time. And relevant as well. You know, I was looking at her tweets a couple of days ago, and they're just so funny still to this day, really.
Yes, interesting side bit of news this morning, Al. They found original prints for the Wurzel Gummidge series that John Pertwee did, I noticed on Twitter.
Yeah, I saw that as well, which is a good thing, because apparently the Nick and Benji podcast discussed Words Were Coming about 3 weeks ago, and the negatives on the use for the DVD are absolutely diabolical, apparently. So hopefully we might get a better version of that, which was quite fun.
Would be superb, of course. Peladon-wise, Al, what did you make of the whole soundscape? I don't suppose there was a huge one in this book, as it's one of the earlier audiobook releases, but I thought David Troughton had a very commanding voice and gave you a sense of urgency throughout the book, as you would in this political situation.
Yeah, I thought the audiobook was very good, what David Troughton did, and I think the soundscape is there. It's quite, you know, when explosions and doors bang and lightning and all those sort of things, it's really good. My niggles with the audiobook is his Pertwee isn't that great. That's my only niggle. I thought his Aliens and Ice Warriors were very good, and his Peladon was very good, but I had niggles with the Pertwee voice. It wasn't that great. Well, I think, yeah, the soundscape is just about right with this, I think, because it is one of the more older ones now. I think there was quite a nice balance.
Yes, this story had a sequel, of course, The Monster of Peladon, when the Doctor returns to Peladon around 30 to 50 years later, but this time with Sarah Jane Smith as his companion. There is a bit of an issue on the DVD. There's a history of the Ice Warriors in the classic series stories that they did, and Terence Dix mentions how they were set up not as the protagonists in the monster story. Do you feel they fit into that sort of Shades of Grey mentality? Sorry, I'll say again. Shades of Grey mentality of Doctor Who villains, the Ice Warriors, in terms of they have their own noble pursuits, but too often are encouraged into devastating war with other species.
Yes, I think sometimes their mythology sort of gets lost. It's not sort of more found out in the last couple of, you know, episodes. They have like Cold War and the Empress of Mars. You know, it's brought back the sort of history of their race, really. And, you know, Big Finish had done quite a bit with the Ice Warriors to show their sort of warlike race. But I think in this episode, the problem is they look great and they sort of, you know, menace about, but they just don't really do a great deal, to be honest. I think sometimes the Ice Warriors sort of are there to just show, you know, stateability and a war race sometimes, I think.
Very noble, I think, is the word that comes to mind.
Yeah, they are noble, and the costumes are fantastic, what they're wearing in this episode and the episodes. They're really stunning. They do look beautiful. But it's this thing, you know, you wouldn't mess with them in this episode, I don't think.
Yes, famously, of course, the original story, Bernard Breslau from the Carry On films was one of the main Ice Warrior characters.
It doesn't surprise me, because they sort of just need that sort of menace, and I think the whispering does improve throughout the years, I think, you know, that whole whispering voice. It's very quiet, very, very subtle. It's meant to be, you know, imperial sometimes, I think.
And in the Mars documentary on the Cursed DVD, Bernard Breslau speaks about that, about how he created the character of the whispering. It's a fascinating piece of archive, if you can listen to it.
Oh, definitely. It's an interesting one, because, you know, it takes time. I think, you know, when Nick Briggs took over as being the Ice Warrior voice. It took him a good month or two to get it right, and he sort of taught other people how to do it. It's a very difficult voice all day, apparently. So, Mike, we of course must discuss the artwork and covers for Curse of Peladon. What do we have for that?
It's a very good Chris Achilleos one, Al, published in 1975, January that year, paperback. And then in those days we had quite a long wait for hardcover copies, which was July 1980. But the same cover on both of those, Chris Achilleos, his famous lifelike pencil drawing of Pertwee in the middle, lower middle of the book, Agador stretching his claws out behind very menacingly, an Ice Warrior to one side, Alpha Centauri to the other side, Doctor Who Pertwee logo, and the Curse of Peladon in sort of purpley brown, as it appears on my computer screen anyway, folks. Apologies if I've got that colour wrong. Brian Hale's very small writing, and that was recreated on the audiobook cover. So, very striking, Al. It certainly reels you in as to see there's a lot going on with different characters in this book.
Yeah, definitely. That's a really nice sort of mixture of the sort of monster and the delegate, sort of, you know, the joys of Alpha Centauri, then sort of. No, so I think the pencil drawings of Pertwee always look rather good, I think. So I don't know if, the, you know, if we got to that era of sort of photoshopping stuff. I don't think it looks as good sometimes.
And published in 1982, a second edition paperback, Doctor Who Red writing in the Pertwee logo this time, and the story's title and the Curse of Peladon in red. Adds a bit more boldness to it, I suppose. Not a lot between those two.
It adds a bit more to the title, I suppose.
I'd say I prefer the original again there, but we did have the release. The Doctor Who blue wave swept effect of the McGann Doctor Who logo again on the audiobook release. Curse of Peladon returned to brown writing. Brian Hale's below, and a copy of the Achilleos collage effect, read by David Troughton in black writing. So that's a pretty good recreation of it for the audiobook.
Yeah, I think that works nicer. I think I still think the red writing slightly works better. It sort of sticks out a bit. Otherwise, I think the artwork works well. I don't know why they sort of changed the thing to the McGann logo sort of look. I don't know.
Stay in all detail now, because if you watch the current releases of everything, it's all gone to the Jodie Whittaker era logo now, hasn't it? Even for the upcoming old DVD releases and for the audiobook releases that are coming.
That is true. Yeah, all Big Finish's stuff have changed to the Jodie logo, so it's sort of probably keeps it in the era, I suppose. Well, my score for Curse of Peladon is a bit mixed, because I really like the TV episodes, because, you know, John Pertwee is fantastic as this sort of bouncing, sort of James Bond Doctor who's, you know, adventurous, you know, does all the sort of great Roman fighting, and the great Agon sort of lullaby bits are brilliant. So I'd probably give the TV episodes probably an 8 or maybe an 8.5. I think the book is good, but it just felt a bit dry in some bits, and I didn't really get the point of why they're all there. So, well, I like the description, so probably a 7 for that. And the audiobook was really well read by David Troughton, except for the occasional annoyances with John Pertwee's voice not being great. Well, I can get round that. So I'd probably give that a 7, I think, for the audiobook.
I think 7.5 for the novelisation, Al. Bit of an A to B effort. We quite often criticise Terence Dix in a certain period of writing Target books for just doing straight up adaptations. I think Brian Hale's, because he's somebody we haven't covered so far yet, adds that sort of new detail. He's very good at the descriptions of characters. He enhances certain scenes, as I mentioned, Agador attacking Hepesh at the end. So a 7.5 solid for that. I'd say an 8 for the TV version, which I do like. But I do feel David's performance is pretty engaging and has enhanced the audiobook, so an 8.5 for that.
Well, that's great. I would agree completely with that, because I think, though, you know, the book is good, it is A to B, unfortunately. You know, this happens, and that happens, basically. So I think Terence occasionally does it slightly better. He does have a habit of doing it in the earlier books, I think. Well, I think, you know, once he got the grips of it. I have to admit, I am looking forward to see how Terence Dix does his short story, because he's in the new Benny Summerfield Chronicle that's coming out for Big Finish.
Oh, excellent. That should be good. I'll keep an eye on that with our Big Finish news coming up in the news later, folks.
Definitely, definitely.
So, but on a whole, Al, I think I'd look forward to reading more Brian Hales. I think he adapted the first Ice Warriors story for Target. Not sure if he did the Monster of Peladon as well, but I certainly look forward to reading more by him.
Yeah, definitely. I did enjoy it, and I think it does work well. I think his descriptions get you through things, and they're very well described. So I would like to read another one of his at some point.
This is Alex Gibbons' Doctor Who News Round.
Hello, this is Hughes News with Alex on the 2nd of August. First thing we have to mention is that in London last weekend we had Comic Con, where for the first time several Doctors were there. We're including Doctor 9, Christopher Eccleston, and also Doctor 11 and 10, Matt Smith and David Tennant, and of course Peter Capaldi, as well as the old Doctors of Peter Davison, Tom Baker, Colin Baker. So for the first time, we actually got a momentous meeting between Christopher Eccleston and Matt Smith, which, if you've seen it online, involved a great hug between the pair of them. Of course, Mike from the Target Files was there at Comic-Con on the Sunday, and we'll have a full sort of roundup of what went on after the news. Unfortunately, we have to mention this week that the actor Alan Benyon, who played three different types of Ice Warriors in the classic episode, and was also the Ice Warriors in the book we're discussing today, The Curse of Peladon, has unfortunately died at the age of 88. From BigFinish.com this week, we have a few things. Mainly, their short trip range has a couple of things out. First thing is Flight into Hole, read by Camille Kadjuri, which, you know, of course, will have something to do with the 10th Doctor, Maeve Rose, as that is, of course, the great Jackie Tyler there again. She's always fantastic reading whatever she reads. Secondly, we have, with Colin Baker, The Darkened Earth, which is another short trip that also involves his new companion, Constance Clark, a Second World War Wren who gets involved with lots of interesting stuff with Colin's great Sixth Doctor. Also from BigFinish.com, we have the second volume of the First Doctor Adventures, with David Bradley taking up the role of the First Doctor. These episodes are written by John Dorney and Andrew Smith, so it should be well interesting, as it's basically taking the characters from the First Doctor era and adding more detail to their era. So, Mike, what are your media and music and all those sort of thing recommendations? And, of course, you were at Comic-Con just this weekend gone. So what happened and what did you get up to?
What a day, Al. Very hot, quite tiresome with all the queuing again, but generally well worth it. Got to meet Christopher Eccleston at his very first convention, got a picture with him. Got to meet one of, probably just edging my favourite of the new series, Doctors, Matt Smith. Got an autograph from David Bradley as well. Went up on the train to London on Saturday. While I was on the train, checked the Wi-Fi. David Tennant had been announced, but there was little to zero chance of me having a decent enough Wi-Fi to pick up Android Pay or whatever, or over the phone credit card. His photo opportunities were gone and autographs were gone in no time. But had a couple of fantastic stories, Al. I'll take you through what happened. Queued for Chris, first of all, early afternoon, Chris Eccleston. Got to the front of the queue, said, "Hello, Chris, how are you?" We usually get, as anybody, as yourself knows, who gets pictures with people at conventions.
They're quick.
We were a bit rushed, but Chris said, "Hello." I said, "Hello, I'm Mike. How are you, Chris?" "Hello, Mike, how are you?" Another bad impression there, sorry. But it's for some reason his voice was... I tend to go quite serious now when I speak to people, Al, like that.
Yeah.
And his voice, I almost expected to come out of his mouth next, was, "It's mauve and dangerous and heading for the middle of London from the empty child." For some reason that came straight into my head, but I just said, "Thank you, Chris." Very happy with how the picture came out. He looked to be having quite a good time, and then later on in the evening, if you saw it, I wasn't present in the building in Olympia, London, but we had the wonderful video of Matt Smith going to his photo queue and Chris Eccleston finishing his, and they had a good handshake, and... my powers of super hearing, not, and lip reading have suggested to me that Matt was saying, we've been waiting for you a long time to do one of these, Chris, and then something inaudible is said by Chris, and then Chris, I think, replies just before he goes, oh, it's nice to see what this was all about. So we can only hope that he's enjoyed his taste of fandom. Must have felt the love there on the day, and hopefully he'll do some more.
Well, we can hope so, because, you know, I've never met him, but I've always heard that he's very nice to his fans and always very good with them. You know, he's done a lot of stuff from the A Word, you know, with different fans from that. I've seen videos of that. Well, we can hope so, because I think he just needs to see nobody actually hates him. I know there was a lot of controversy when he left the Doctor era, you know, Doctor. I don't know if he's wanted to go back to it that much, to be honest. But I think it'd be great if he could get him back.
Yeah, I want to say, Al, that I think, you know, at the time, BBC Wales wasn't known for national drama. They were taking a big risk bringing this show back. Although, you know, we had the gravitas of Chris at the time, who was an established actor at the time, along with Billy, who wasn't that well known, although she'd done the Canterbury Tales superbly just before Doctor Who was broadcast. So we had something really in its infancy in terms of Doctor Who, so that they got it made and it was as good as it was overall, was some sort of miracle anyway, really. But, you know, he set the way, and you had the feeling when on the video of Matt meeting him and how in awe Matt was of him, and even Peter Capaldi, there's another video of him leaving the building and bumping into Chris with a huge smile on both of their faces. So you got a sense that they do owe something to Chris for it paving the way for them to be able to play the Doctor.
Yeah, I think that's totally true. I think, you know, if he hadn't done such a good and interesting performance, I don't think you would have had, you know what BBC thought of Doctor Who. BBC Wales took a complete risk on Doctor Who when it came back, and, you know, because the BBC absolutely hated it. We have to put our hands up and say, you know, the BBC did not want Doctor Who to come back for Bunny Ross, and it was done so brilliantly, that first series, and it sort of went, well, yeah, it makes money, it will be great, and it was, and that's why, you know, you have to respect Christopher Eccleston. I've always liked Christopher Eccleston, whatever he did, basically, but I think he has a lot to be thankful for, you know, in the whole Doctor Who world, written, people should, really.
I do wonder if he was coming in now to do a series, he'd probably do more than one, because it's so well established at BBC Wales.
Yeah, I think now it's a completely different ballpark, you know, it's like, you sign up for, you know, now you know what Doctor Who's going to be good, and it's good for your career. You sign up for a 3-year contract now, don't you, basically? I think that's what rumoured Jodie signed up for, and it's like, you know, you wouldn't punt it now, you know, because back then when it started, you'd probably go, well, you know, it's Doctor Who. Is this actually a good idea acting choice-wise? I think, you know, when it came back, it was still a bit, we don't know if this is a good idea or not. Category, I think.
Yes, and also wanted to tell a story, Al. Apparently, by the end of mid-afternoon, Matt Smith ended up being an hour for the photo opportunity that myself and a number of others had with him for the photo session. Largely thanks the rumour was that a lot of people were having upwards of 5 to 6 items signed.
And were they bankrupting themselves? Because we all know Comic-Con autographs are about £85, weren't they, for David Tennant?
Quite possibly so, when you take into account that the actors as people, of course, have to have their lunch breaks and everything as well. We were waiting for nearly an hour, worried we were all going to miss our photo opportunities because this was an hour and a half before the venue closed at 6 p.m. All of a sudden, I see this figure just behind the corner of my eyes walking up, and it's Mr. Smith has finally arrived. He looks towards us, he sees we're all a bit tired and down, and he shouts out with a big smile on his face, "Hello, guys!" and runs up doing the wavy Doctor arms, which got a massive cheer and just put everyone back in the zone then, and well done to Matt for spotting that. Say again, sorry?
What was he wearing that day?
He had a general sort of black tracksuit hoodie on and a pair of jeans, as you can see in the video with the video of Chris Eccleston.
Yeah, that video is great for Chris. I have seen that. I just wondered that. So, but it's just like that sort of shows how, you know, when people have been queuing for an hour, like, you know, queuing's horrible anyway, but it's sort of, you know, it gives you that ethos to actually think, oh yeah, he's actually here for us, I suppose.
And Doctor Who-wise, I also got autographs as well from David Bradley, who was lovely. I went up and I was a little bit fawning. I said, thank you for bringing Bill back to life in Adventure in Space and Time, and thank you for bringing the first Doctor back to life in Twice Upon a Time. And he was very humbled by that. He signed a lovely autograph picture for me. And I also took a Doctor Who magazine cover of Pearl Mackey up to the lovely lady herself and found that she was lovely as well.
And didn't you say we also got Ingrid Oliver and Arthur Darvels as well?
Almost forgot Ingrid, sorry, and Arthur as well. Yes, a lovely photo with Ingrid, a little bit rushed again. And I actually saw Arthur and Karen filming here in Swansea 7 years ago now for the Let's Kill Hitler episode. And a good friend of mine of ours from Regeneration, Simon Watkins, I remember my phone battery dying at the time, so he took a picture on his iPhone at the time and kept it for me.
Oh, and fantastic.
Knowing I was going to this convention this week, I took my memory card into Tesco's and had a nice little print, A3 print of that done up. And I got Arthur to sign half of it, and he's left a bit of a space for hopefully meeting Karen again one day. So
you hope?
Oh, yes. I think Alex knows she's probably my favourite lady in the Doctor Who history, so...
Oh, yes. You know, well, you never know. She might do one in England at some point soon.
Yeah, but, to be honest, before last weekend, I thought it would probably be the 60th anniversary before we saw Messrs. Tennant and Smith again, and we had the added bonus, of course, of Chris doing his very first one, which was announced a lot sooner, thankfully a few months back.
Oh, really? That's the only thing I've put my hands at slightly annoyed with Comic-Con, that they were adding people on the weekend of it actually being on.
Yeah, people have mentioned this online, Al. They shouldn't really call it a convention because there's not much time to do everything. You have to pay for the talks that go on generally with the biggest stars.
You pay for the talks, you pay for the photo, the autograph.
They should call it London Film and Comic Expo, really, because what you and I see as a convention is something smaller scale, sort of Regenerations, Big Finish.
Yeah, that's a convention where it's all inclusive, isn't it, of who's who, of people from any form of that sort of world, really.
Yeah, but we had some huge stars there, like, you know, Jason Momoa, David Duchovny were there as well. And
was he there on Sunday, David Duchovny?
Yes, that was all added into the queues. Apparently, at one point, you could just go straight up to the front of his queue because there was so
what
much...
Was old Poldark there on Sunday?
Yes, he was. A good friend of mine, Susie, was. I saw her just before she was about to go and get a picture with him, very happy. And a lot of women 40s in our generation were very enamoured by the Dukes of Hazzard boys, especially John Schneider.
I bet. How are they looking these days?
Looking well. John's looking still about 30, annoyingly. You know, I'm older than that now. I remember being about 5 or 6 when the TV show was on. Tom Wolpert, the other one's looking aging pretty well. And Catherine Bach, the lovely Daisy, I got a signed picture from her.
Very well. I've seen that photo you've got. She's aging very well.
Yeah, she is aging very well. So... a good weekend in all, Al. A bit of a struggle. It can feel like a bit of a marathon, and you can feel drained walking around that big venue all day. They really do need to move.
It would have helped if I had been there, because I could have queue jumped.
Yes, Al. They had the people who required a little bit of support. You know, partially sighted, sometimes with sort of learning disabilities. They had the stewards helping them to the front of the queue. So,
do you think Sunday still would have been a bit too much for me?
Only for this year, Al, only because they crammed everyone in last minute.
Again, didn't it? We were planning to do Sunday. The only reason they didn't do it because of funds, basically, because I sat there and worked out there was too much I would have gone for.
Yes, and I suppose the annoying thing this year was that Tom Baker was able to do the Friday between 10 and 10.
I've got to get... It's on my hit list. I'm going to have to find time with Tom at, because I want to get him before I have the Nick Courtney problem again.
Yes, Tom... was there between 10 and 2 on the Friday only. There just wasn't logistics and time, but people were wondering if we could have had a massive panel with all the doctors. God knows how long that would have cost.
That would have been mental. I think the only doctor who wasn't there was Silk, wasn't he, for some reason? Silk was meant to be there, and then...
And Mrs. Jodie, of course, but, you know, we'll hopefully...
Yeah, the main Mrs. Jodie, that would be great. And Paul McGann, Paul McGann was there, wasn't he? And Colin and the rest of them.
Yeah, Paul walked behind me at one point across the venue. He walked just right past me, and I was in a bit of awe again, you know, having met him though before.
It's no one I really want to meet.
He tends to do them fairly often in this country, chance.
I've seen they've got the one in the Exeter Comic Con coming up in September, but it's a bit, I was looking at the list, it's not the greatest, to be honest.
No, I find the one in Cardiff doesn't have the greatest guests anymore. The last time I went was around about 2014, where they had Paul McGann.
I think they've put so far for Comic Con down here. It's Sophie, it's Fraser, it's I think Holly from Red Dwarf. It's a couple, you know, it's not people we haven't all seen before, unfortunately.
Yes, we're having a new arena built in Swansea.
Really?
As I speak, where the old council offices on the front are being moved out, so they've been moved elsewhere in the city, so we're going to have a new arena there, so maybe a con one day. Depends what sort of guests we'll get.
But what I would say, that if I'd known who was going to be there earlier, I would have probably come with you this year. That's what annoyed me a little bit.
Yeah, you can't really guarantee though with Showmasters. They will let you know throughout the year we are trying for guests until the last minute, so you do have a rush.
Yeah, it's sort of, you know, there was... took, you know, if I'd known in like May, but it was going to be Duchovny, Turner, and all the Doctors, I would have been there.
And then you do still get the risk of somebody pulling out Megan Fox.
Like Megan, what, did they replace Megan Fox, or did this go so you couldn't come?
Goodness knows what the queues would have been like with her there as well, Al. It was packed enough.
Yeah, because she would have been there the whole weekend as well. So, how far back, to give us an idea, were the queues?
Olympia is a huge venue, and they open.
It's mammoth, isn't it?
They open both sides of the dome area.
Oh, thank God of that! They did open both sides,
all two floors, and you are sort of queued in as snakes. You know, they do have proper queue lines written on the floor, so it is like
not
that. But
too bad.
They call you in batches of people, though. You know, batch one to say batch 10 with some of the biggest stars.
They have got better then. I know that could become a bit chaotic.
And people will congregate around the edge of those queues, so that makes things more difficult. But you know, you can understand, because like myself with Matt Smith, I was worried about missing the opportunity.
Yeah, exactly. Because of, you know, you miss it, it's like no chance, unfortunately.
But that's enough of my entertainment recommendations for about half an hour. I'll have yours.
Yeah. Just coming back to normal. What else have you actually been watching? Anything?
No, I'm still following Airwolf repeats on UK TV.
Talk about me
and the Goldbergs is fantastic.
Keeping faith, and I will be watching the original House of Cards on BBC iPlayer, which is still really good with Ian Ritson as Francis Urquhart. That's really quite fun.
Never saw him in Doctor Who, I don't think, but he would have been good.
He would have been great as sort of a very master, sort of very slimy bad. He would have been great in that. Keeping faith, which is really good. Eve Miles being fantastic in that.
Have you caught up with Mission Impossible at the cinema?
I have indeed. I went and saw it last Thursday, and it is absolutely excellent. Even Henry Cavill is actually quite good as a baddie in it. Wow. And if you want to see a very nasty shot of Tom Cruise's knee going up the creek, it's in the film. They haven't edited it out.
Oh, yes. Wasn't it his foot or his knee? His foot.
His knee jump, and they do like this base jump onto a nightclub in Paris, and Henry Cavill's air thing goes up the creek, so sort of Tom Cruise's character saves him, and in the process slams his knee into the roof.
Ouch. I did see
you can actually see the wince on Cruise's face. It's very, very good.
I did see a 360 video of Tom on location in New Zealand for the helicopter stunt, and you get an idea of how high up he was, and the man is literally insane.
Simon Pegg's really good in it as well, as the sort of tech guy. I can remember his name, but he's really good in it.
Yeah, I always worry with each of those movies whether they're going to kill him off, because he's such a good character. I hope they don't.
No, he's still in one piece just about this time. He does get close to being killed.
I still remember seeing the first one in the cinema in 96.
I saw it in the cinema, I think, about 20 years ago now. And I think they haven't really gone downhill. I think there was a little blips in some of them, but I think this one is definitely one of the strongest ones.
They have found their own identity quite quickly and taken over. A lot of the more recent ones are better than the Bond films, I think.
Yeah, I think they have that sort of ethos that Bond had, but I think they're a lot dark. I think they're about the right balance. I don't know. I think Bond sometimes goes a bit too dark.
Hopefully Danny Boyle can give us something to finish the Craig era off with.
Well, hopefully so. Danny Boyle doing that'll be interesting.
And Star Wars 9 started shooting yesterday, didn't it? And we have Richard E. Grant cast, which is very interesting.
Yeah, I don't know what he's been cast as, but he's in it. And I know there's sort of a lot of winding up this trilogy and references to all the prequels, I think. And there's going to be lots of Force ghosts, I think.
Wouldn't be surprised to see a CGI battle.
Well, they've done a very cunning trick by taking all the extra footage on The Force Awakening and make so they can get Carrie Fisher into it.
Yeah, it's be interesting to see how they drop that in, whether it's just sort of a brief chat with whoever survives out of Kylo and Rey at the end, or if they both do.
I don't know. I think it's going to be the best one. You never know. I'm actually saying that the one everybody hates, I really liked.
Last Jedi, yeah, I did enjoy it.
Next time, Doctor Who Target Files, we'll be discussing Doctor Who, The Invisible Enemy, written by Terence Dix, with the audiobook performed by John Leeson. You can contact Doctor Who Target Files on Twitter at DW Target Files handle, or search Facebook for our podcast page and leave a message. Thanks for listening.
Doctor Who Target Files, The Curse of Peladon Review, featured Michael Winks and Alexander Gibbons. 12th Doctor Theme, composed originally by Murray Gold. Version for the podcast by Vale Mystery. Please do check out their YouTube channel, VAYLE Mystery. News Round, opening and closing themes, composed originally by Ted Heath and his orchestra, and by John Baker. Doctor Who Target Files, The Curse of Peladon Review, was recorded in Swansea, Wales, UK, and Exeter, Devon, England, UK, during August 2018.